Very happy to be here. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me and organizing this wonderful conference. It's the first time since COVID coming back to Perimeter. It feels like finally COVID is ending. So I want to talk about data-centric learning. But before I go into my talk, I want to have a brief advertisement on the APS topical group in data science. How many of you know about GDS? So this is a group, topical group, which means it's not a division yet. I've been just elected into the chair line and doing my due diligence. So if you have your phone, you can take a picture of this QR code that will take you to the link that will allow you to join the GDS. Usually to join a group, it costs you $10, US dollars. But right now there is a discount. So there's a coupon code, okay? So if you go to this Join GDS link, if you go to this link, then you will have to log in. Once you log in, you'll get to the site which is where you specify all your subscriptions, essentially, to different divisions. And GDS needs to reach 3% of APS membership to be become a division. Last year, they got 2.9%, came a little short. So this year, we're hoping to reach the 3% to become a division. And here is the all-important coupon code, GDS23-FirstYearFree. Then you get that $10 off, all right? Okay, so why am I taking my precious time of my, you know, my talk time to talk about this GDS? I think it is kind of important that we define ourselves as a community. Most of conferences I go, I'm not the oldest person in the room. Here also, I'm not exactly the oldest person in the room, but this community is definitely a lot younger than other communities that the conferences that I attend. And I think it is important that we define ourselves as a community. And you join GDS, when you submit your abstracts, you submit to GDS, there it will not be so much about trying to find your way into one specific topic, but it could be much more broader where you can talk about interdisciplinary research. All right, so enough of advertisement. Let me get on to my topic. I am by training a condensed matter theorist, a quantum condensed matter theorist, and what I have always loved doing is trying to connect complex experimental data with some theoretical insight and say, well, from some microscopic model perspective, there is some sort of mechanism for ordering. Maybe there is some Goldstone mode fluctuation. Maybe there is entanglement, these kind of theoretical concepts. I always wanted to connect the real data with these kind of insight. And now increasingly, quantum hardwares are becoming available, and we would like to fold that into our thinking. And in trying to do all of this, because of the development in the data acquisition techniques and the detectors and new ideas, we are really facing data-driven data revolution. And I want to accelerate and improve the way we can make these connections using machine learning tools. So what do I mean by data revolution? This is literally taken from the Nobel Prize winning paper by Bragg and Bragg, father and son, 1913, Proceedings of Royal Society. So what won them the Nobel Prize? What won them the prize was being able to explain these three peaks with a little bit of exaggeration. So they came up with the very first Ford model for an analysis of X-ray data, which is to assume that there are maybe planes of atoms, and those planes could give rise to these peaks when the conditions are right, and there was one parameter that was the distance between the plane, and that is the no less than the Bragg condition that we learned in high school physics. clearly, when something appears in high school physics textbook, it is a successful model. Now, fast forward to today, we don't look at three peaks. We get 100,000 peaks. And now what can we do with all this data? There's got to be a lot more information, but how do we extract information from this kind of data? This is Stern-Gerlach experiment. This is a plaque remembering Stern and Gerlach's very first experiment. And this experiment was, in a way, the humanities' very first experiment making a projective measurement. So here are two states associated with a Hilbert space of single spin. And this was the beginning of the human starting to understand what quantum mechanical world is like. Now, fast forward to today, we don't do projective measurement on one qubit. You know, now there are hundreds of qubits available. Different platforms are racing to reach 1,000, 10,000. And now the Hilbert space that we're exploring with these hardwares are obviously really big. What can we do with that? So over the course of last 6-7 years, actually since my previous sabbatical, I'm currently at the end of my sabbatical, second sabbatical. Since my previous sabbatical, my group has been exploring different ways of using machine learning tools to address data-driven problems in the study of quantum many-body systems. And today I want to focus on the studies involving large volumes of X-ray data and studies involving data from quantum simulators and quantum hardwares. So first, X-ray. This effort was really led by my former student, Jordan Vandeley. And we had a great fun and, you know, overcoming learning to speak each other's languages with when three different domains meet. One is the colleagues coming from computer science, machine learning background, and then there are colleagues coming from Argonne National Lab and CHESS with X-ray experimental background and people in my group. So what can you do with X-ray? X-ray can tell us about orders and fluctuations involving charge that electromagnetic wave couples to. If you have, in a fully symmetric system, this is a cartoon picture of two sites within a unit cell, one-dimensional lattice. If this is your fully symmetric system, a charge density wave that increases the size of the unit cell, doubles the size of the unit cell, would look like this in real space, but that's not what we get to see directly. What we get to see is appearance of new superlattice peaks right here, and these are new superlattice peaks. Another thing that you can notice is that these different superlattice peaks are not all the same at different Brillouin zones. That's telling us about actual structure within the unit cell. There can be intra-unit cell order that does not change the unit cell size, but changing the structure within the unit cell. And to study something like that, you do not get a new Bragg peak, so new superlattice peak, unlike when you're changing the unit cell size, but instead you have to study subtle changes going from zone to zone. And then there are fluctuations that's just, you know, fuzzy, giving you kind of a diffuse scattering. So these are different things that can come out in X-ray. Now, this is sort of representation of data taken at Argonne over spanning a temperature range. And what you can observe in this 3D intensity map is that something's changing. It seems to be becoming busier as you go down to lower temperature. So how have we been studying such data traditionally? Traditional approach is to take a cut, because 3D intensity distribution is very hard to visualize and quantify. So researchers will go to the facility, take data for a week, they come back, and they log into the system. The volume is too big to carry home, so they log into the system after they're done their measurements. They will make a cut with some, you know, guided by their insight and goal, and look at a handful of cuts and try to fit the curves. Now, instead, what you can do is now our algorithm is actually incorporated into the data analysis software at APS, Advanced Photon Source at Argonne National Lab. Researchers, while they are taking the experiment, they're doing the measurement, they can hit a button. I'll show you the button in a minute. You can hit a button and get X-TEC outcome. What does X-TEC tell you? X-TEC will tell you where are regions in the reciprocal space, all of this, that has to do with charge density wave, and where are regions that has to do with Bragg peaks and diffuse scattering, for instance. So how does it work, and why is this a good idea? Well, you have large volume of data, some of it is noise, and there are mixed signals. And how do you sort through that data in an exhaustive way instead of ad hoc selecting a few peaks? We needed a sorting criteria because it's clearly a sorting problem. So what would be a good sorting criteria that is kind of broadly applicable? Often we are interested in some collective phenomena that has to do with interactions. And what will be balancing that interaction effect will be entropy. So often data is taken as a function of temperature for the reason that we are interested in how what state is realized trying to minimize the free energy. So you have data set taken at different temperatures. Now what we're going to do is to take that data set as a data that's a point in the dimensional space where that's given by the number of temperature points. The reason is once you think of a curve is as instead of a curve, a point in a high dimensional space, you can cluster it because a point is local. So we want to think of the data as a point in a temperature dimensional space. If I have 20 temperature points, it's a 20 dimensional space. And depending on the role of that data point in a particular collective phenomena of interest, we expect different behavior in the evolution of temperature. So before we approach this problem, to the best of my knowledge, none of the X-ray researchers, experimentalists, were plotting the raw intensities as a function of time. But that's what we requested because we wanted to see, you know, whether there are different trends, whether it would be a good idea to try this. And this is what a good data look like. So what you can see here is that there seem to be sort of a collection of curves that are coming down around 130 Kelvin. There's another collection of curves that seems to be kind of unsteady. These are intensities at different reciprocal space points. And then there's a lot of sort of background. Now, what does it look like? It looks like, let's see if I can get this cool fanciness going. So the sound that you were listening to is supposed to be my all high-tech presentation was going well until this moment. It was supposed to be people, you know, a crowd. A lot of people are talking over each other. And that's what sort of what data looks like. So data looks like there are a mixture of signal, and we want to be able to separate them. Just like when you have people talking over each other, you might want to separate one person's voice out of other people's voice or noise. So approach that's quite useful in doing something like this, a robust, simple approach is Gaussian mixture model, and that's what we're going to do. So what we do is we have different temperature points, and I'm presenting what it will look like if I look at just two temperature points, that so that I have a two-dimensional space that is easy to visualize. If I have 25 temperature points, I'm actually doing running the algorithm in 25-dimensional space. But if I just collect all the data at these two temperature points at different reciprocal space, I'm going to get a scatter plot based on what the intensity of a particular Q was at 130 Kelvin and what the intensity of that particular Q, if I follow it, at 30 Kelvin. And that gives me this kind of scatter. And you can already see there is sort of a grouping. And this grouping is representing how the intensity changed going from one point in temperature to another point in temperature. So if I do this in full, you know, 25-dimensional space where this data was taken, I am really grouping, looking at the distribution of data depending on how they evolved as a function of temperature. And then what we do is clustering using Gaussian mixture model, where you have your model to be consisting of a mixture of Gaussians, where your mean and variance are to be learned, and the weight of a particular Gaussian represented by mean and weight are also to be learned. And the training is to take all the data we have and to find the maximum likelihood solution for the weights and the means and the variances. And once we are done the training, we have the weight the cluster assignment. And with the data that I was demonstrating with here, there are clearly two clusters that are well separated. Here, we are marking three clusters. It doesn't look so separated when we take the two temperature points, but if we take all the temperature points, they are actually separated. So this is the sort of the inner workings of this X-ray temperature series clustering, what we call in short X-TEC. And we use this to go from, go from this raw data to find clusters, here four clusters, and different representative behaviors. So what you can see here is there's one representative behavior that clearly looks like onset of ordering, another representative behavior that looks like onset of ordering. So there will be a cluster associated with this behavior, which will be a set of Q points, which will tell us what the order parameter is. And there will be a cluster associated with this behavior, which will be different Q points, which will also tell us where that ordering is occurring. So we use this approach in analyzing X-ray data from cadmium renate, which is a pyrochlorate system that goes through structural transition. It is also a superconductor down at low temperatures, but it was this intermediate phase where there's a clear, large thermodynamic signal of a specific heat peak, but the structural distortions were so small, it was really hard to detect what the structural structure was in this phase. So there were two candidates. One is a one-dimensional T2U structure, and the other is two-dimensional order parameter EU structure. If you have a two-dimensional order parameter, it's kind of like XY model. You have two axes, and there must be Goldstone mode fluctuation if you are getting an ordering in a two-dimensional order parameter. So detection of Goldstone mode fluctuation could be a definite signature pointing to this particular ordering, but until this point, we didn't know how to look for such signatures. So we were given 8 terabytes of data, and we run the algorithm. In 10 minutes, algorithm gives us the clustering outcome. That was not the end of it. It took us 2 more months to figure out what the heck it meant, because we got surprising results. We didn't think there would be multiple clusters, and we found multiple clusters in a region where we weren't expecting. And then it took us more than a year afterwards to get it published, which is kind of irrelevant. But the part that has to do with, it took us 10 minutes to get the data, the analysis, and then it took us 2 months to figure out what it meant. First of all, proves that we found something, we discovered something that we didn't know to expect. And that's exciting. It also tells us that what was done in those 10 minutes would not have been possible without the use of this algorithm. So what did we discover? So the first thing we discovered was that there are in this, at the same temperature, there is ordering phenomena, but there are two clusters that's clearly represented by different temperature dependence. One, they both turn on simultaneously, which means they are associated with the same kind of global ordering, but one is kind of more suppressed and the other is turning on more readily. And then we looked at, this is the interpretation of the learning outcome. We look at which reciprocal space points each cluster came to. And this is the mapping. It's very straightforward. We have a cluster, we look up where they came from. Which population are they? And look, this is very, very orderly. And it immediately jumped out and spoke to us. There's gotta be some principle under this. This is way too organized. Now, this kind of organization can result in if there is something called selection rule. So, you know, we searched what could this mean, and we realized, first of all, we can parameterize all the yellows having to do with this kind of indexing, all the greens having to do with this kind of indexing. And once we were able to articulate the machine learning results into a simple selection rule, we could try to figure out what could that mean. And we realized what this means is that the displacement occurring in this order phase are putting the rhenium's and cadmium's out of phase. It is an intra-unit cell information. This is a very large unit cell and very subtle, small, small-scale information. And it was first time such information could be accessed. Next thing we realized, this is the real part that we were puzzled for 2 months. We went back to do more measurements, et cetera. Now, in the previous slide, I represented each region simply with one dot because we were averaging over a Bragg peak and averaging into one pixel. But now we opened it up and we looked at it in more detail and we realized the diffuse regions around each Bragg peak were not all the same. Some were showing much more enhanced intensity in the phase, intermediate phase, but some were much more suppressed. And that was really puzzling to my colleagues. They never knew that such thing is possible. They never thought diffuse scattering would be different in such an orderly way. And there was a same selection rule associated with one type of diffuse region and another type of diffuse region. And my experimentalist colleagues wouldn't believe that there can be such behavior until they saw the raw data. So here's a plot of the raw data. And you can see from the intensity plot that how the diffuse scattering gets is kind of enhanced in this phase is very different between the two regions. And then we were able to reason. It took us 1 month to come to believe this is true. And then it took us another month to figure out what could be going on. And finally, we realized, oh, that's what you should expect if you have Goldstone mode fluctuations because of the structure that it is fluctuating in between. First of all, when you have Goldstone mode fluctuations in the order phase, throughout the order phase, when you are ordering in like XY model, like 2D order parameter, usually fluctuations are isolated to just the critical region, but in this case, you would have fluctuation throughout the order phase. And the structure that we are seeing these fluctuations were closely, we could model it with including the fluctuation effects by modeling the Goldstone mode fluctuations. So this was the first discovery that was enabled by XTEC. Since then, we've been able to apply this method on various different types of materials. We discovered signatures of Bragg glass in rare tritelluride that has been disordered. We've also studied Kagome metal, and these are more recent papers. And here comes the button. This is the screenshot of the software that is used for analyzing X-ray data at Advanced Photon Source and at CHESS, Cornell High Energy Synchrotron Source. And there is you can just enable this plugin and press one button to get all this analysis, you know, real time. And what this means is that the researchers, while experimentalists, while they're doing the research, at the facility that they have to, you know, plan in advance and sign up for, you know, they can take data, go get coffee, come back and see where interesting things are happening. And if they don't find anything interesting, they will change the parameters and redo experiments right there. Moreover, we have now found that this algorithm that we have developed, really just building on fundamentally at the core of it is a very simple Gaussian mixture model. But it now can be applied to time-resolved X-ray data and 4D scanning transmission electron microscopy data. And we are actually even using similarly structured model to analyze data from neurons grown on chip, which sounds very different. But what we have realized over the course of exploring the application of this algorithm is that there are many problems where a simple starting point can get you pretty far and get you a huge mileage. So what we are doing now is to, on one hand, expand where we look at different problems where this can be useful for, but we are also developing XTech 2.0, where the number of clusters are, at the moment, number of clusters are one parameter that the researcher has to kind of ad hoc choose and experiment with. We're trying to come up with more principled way of choosing the number of parameters. So now I want to switch gear and I'll talk about decoding quantum simulator data. But before I switch gear and talk about something pretty different, any questions at this point? Yes?
Short question. You are talking about lattice structure and these superstructures and so on. What about magnetic structures? Because when it comes to magnetism, there are fascinating, for example, in cerium nictide, you have this devil staircase and so on. So can machine discover that?
That's a great idea. So it's a question of what kind of probe we use to access magnetism. Traditional probe for studying magnetism is neutron scattering. There are increasingly more resonant X-ray scattering also being used to study magnetism. So we're collaborating with Matteo Mitrano at Harvard in looking at various resonant X-ray approaches and also time-resolved X-ray study. With more direct will be neutron, and what is required is for us to be able to talk to the right person, There is increasing interest, but there is, in a way, this is sort of interface problem, right? Different communities have developed in much more of an isolation.
It's a network.
Yeah, exactly. And, adventurous young people talking to each other. That's what's really needed. This X-ray data analysis, we started by trying to apply a tool that was on the shelf that was already developed by my colleague Killian's group, which was Gaussian process mixture model, which worked really great on Gates Foundation health data, but it really struggled with our data. And my student Jordan really pulled it apart and realized there is much simpler thing we can do that would work. And in making that first success, it was a long adventure, epic adventure, I think. It was really an epic adventure where, through which we had to learn to talk to each other, trust each other, and talk to each other, and try to understand what is really going on. And it was something that I've never done before. but it was an investment that we made because we believed in the cause. We didn't know how broadly useful it will be. I thought if it is going to be useful, I will find out that it is useful within 6 months. I was way off with that time scale. First of all, to get through refereeing took forever. But it's just starting to happen. I'm just starting to get calls from people saying, maybe can you also look at this kind of data? So I think it's just starting to happen. And I think this is something that's going to happen increasingly. I was just looking at summer camp options for my middle schooler. And after learning a little bit of Python, you can do machine learning. Virtual summer school, middle schoolers can. So imagine what it would be like 6 years from now when these kids come to college. What would it be like 10 years from now when they come to graduate school, right? So there will be much more readiness and familiarity. There's a delay. The time it takes for new computational development to penetrate. But I think it's going to happen. So now I'm going to switch gears and talk about decoding quantum simulator data. Now we are all quite familiar with these kind of quantum hardwares. They are becoming available. What they do, they prepare state. And how do we access that state? We access the state through projective measurements. So you can have a fancy machine. At the end of the day, what you get are a bunch of zeros and ones. And the challenge of the large dimensionality of the space is that, with 53 qubits, you get this large dimensional space that you can, in principle, explore. You go way over the volume of data that is in the Library of Congress, and how do we explore this space? How do we figure out what is going on our system? We have, this is another epic adventure. We've made attempts and efforts, and you know, some were less successful than we hoped. We are now in phase three. I'm going to talk about phase one, phase two, phase three. Phase one started with generative modeling. So this was work that we did in collaboration with former student Peter Cha and colleagues at computer science and applied physics. And also Juan, somehow Juan's picture is missing here, but Juan's also one of our co-authors in this paper. The idea was, you know, this was early on, although published in 2021, we started working in 2019. It was early in the days of large language model before ChatGPT became household name. We thought maybe the structure of this transformer, the underlying large language models, could be helpful in learning long-range entanglement. It was kind of a loose idea, but why did we think it will work? Well, this is the attention mechanism, how the attention mechanism works. If I have a sentence, he lives in the White House. Thinking about the meaning of the sentence, wanting to learn the meaning of the sentence if you want to, you don't want to look at dictionary meaning of each of the words. So no matter how well you understand the meaning of the word white and the meaning of the word house, unless you put them together and think of them together, you'll be very far from knowing who he is referring to. But once you take white and house together, and then take he together, you immediately know who he is. At least in US, people do. Okay, so how does this work? This is something that language model's goal was, right? To be able to take into account different words that are far in distance that you want to be able to take together. The attention mechanism works in the following way. There are two matrices to be learned, query and key, and you are doing rotation in the space of vectors. It's a little bit like Rubik's Cube. So you take one vector representation of your sentence and take two independent rotations, and you are adjusting those rotations until you find the score that works well. So by just simply rotating in this space, you are allowing for words that are far apart to come next to each other and be taken into account together. What is lacking is the absolute order and positioning, which is what things like CNN are very good for, because the image recognition is done by understanding what's close to each other, local. But for language, you needed to realize that you have to kind of take away this whole notion of distance in a way. You need to be able to learn the words no matter how far they are if they need to be thought together. So the attention mechanism is in a way quite different from how, say, CNN or other neural network for image recognition works. And because it is designed to take the information that are far apart together, it is designed for learning some correlations between the data input. So that was our vision, and we wanted to take data from hardware and try to reconstruct the density matrix. The approach that we developed using transformer worked in a way, meaning that we were able to get classical fidelity of 99% with less measurement than, for instance, RNN at the time. And we could do, you know, as well as the conventional method of MLE-based tomography. However, we couldn't beat the exponential wall. So it wasn't, you know, the sort of hope in the promise of maybe machine learning being able to handle large dimensional space, that maybe part was problematic. There wasn't a magic in that particular direction, which was our main target. So then we kind of were disappointed, and I was disappointed, and we decided to lower our bar. Okay, let's see if we can learn classical information. So we just changed the strategy completely, stepped away from trying to use transformer or attention mechanism and saw, you know, can we learn something from these snapshots, projective measurements? And that gets us to this paper. There were actually two papers, one before this, which was led by my former student, Cole Miles. So here we are trying to learn something from a collection of snapshots taken from this Rydberg quantum simulator. What we wanted to do was that the experimentalists explore the phase space and make lots and lots of snapshots at a different point in phase space. Although what was already published were cases where what to be expected was known, we wanted to be able to discover without preconceived notions. So what we first did was to combine the unsupervised learning with supervised learning. In order to do unsupervised learning kind of clustering as we did for X-ray, we needed to first lower the dimensionality of the space. So we compressed the data and we did some PCA to reduce the dimensionality. And then what we discovered was that in that phase space that was explored by the experimentalists, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different regions. They knew 3 regions, but 5 is, you know, 2 more than 3. So there were some things that they didn't know before. To figure out what those are, what we did was now supervised learning. We'll park ourselves in the center of each phase and do use interpretable neural network architecture, correlated convolutional neural network, which is hacked from CNN, to be much more interpretable. And we were able to learn different phases and gain new insight. For learning these two phases, we used regularization path analysis, which allows us to, what it does is it deprives the neural network the desire to use more input, and because it is really penalized for using input, it will choose to use just the input that is most informative. That way we are able to figure out, okay, these are the features that are most informative of a given phase. And that led us to discovering what we call edge order phase, and also features associated with this rhombic or pneumatic phase. But at the end of the day, these were sort of classical ordering patterns. More recently, we've taken this to learning features that have to do with phases that are not specified by order parameter. This is something that my student Kevin, who is here. Kevin, where are you? Over there, back. So he's giving a poster tomorrow. You'll learn more about it from Kevin. But this is sort of the idea. We took the DMRG wave function as if it is out of a hardware and studied the wave function by studying its snapshots. And we were able to learn features associated with U1 quantum spin liquid, which was very exciting. That was stage 2. Now, stage 3, based on what we learned to be the limits, and based on what we learned to be what is possible by collecting, looking at the snapshots as a collection, we are now going back to the question of, can we learn quantum complexity or something about a collection of bit strings from the data? And this is my student Hejin, who is also here, is giving a poster tomorrow. She's going to be able to tell you more details about this, but I will sort of give you the big picture of what this is about. So in this 3 phases, we started by asking, can attention mechanism offer us new handle, new tool into studying quantum data? And in the first effort, we wanted to do tomography. Tomography means you want to know everything, because if you have the density matrix, you know everything. And we hoped maybe transformer can help us beat the exponential wall, but as we implemented at the time, it definitely was not beating the exponential wall. So, you know, there is something that you want to do, and you know, you just are not getting quite at that. What can you do? For phase 2, we lowered our bar all the way and said, let me just try to learn some patterns where there is ordering. And now we're coming back to our original ambition, but with a little more realistic perspective. Density matrix, wanting to learn density matrix is wanting to learn everything. And clearly, you won't be able to learn everything about exponentially large phase space. Neither do you really need to learn everything. So then the question is, when I don't try to generate the density matrix, can I learn something? And is there an advantage in using a tension mechanism as we envisioned loosely at the beginning about correlation, etc., in doing such so? And I think the answer is now definitely yes, and this is something that I want to talk about. So that gets us to attention to quantum complexity. The quantum complexity specific target that we're going to be looking at is this kind of random circuit that was introduced in this paper on quantum supremacy. But supremacy or non-supremacy is not our goal. Our goal is to use this data as a challenge to see whether we can learn complex quantum state. So how do you define complexity of a quantum state? Complexity of a state can be defined by minimum number of operations that are necessary to arrive at a particular state, starting from a simple product state. If I am arriving at a different state by doing various circuit operations, then complexity of state amounts to, loosely speaking, the depth of the circuit. And therefore, when you think of this kind of random circuit, you anticipate as you increase depth, the complexity will increase. This particular type of random circuit with two qubit gates and single qubit gates is structured enough. It is known that without noise, if you go deep enough, you'll reach a particular state that's characterized by Porter-Thomas distribution, the distribution of the bit strings. So if you open up this paper, you'll find their sort of climax plot to be this. Any question?
You define complexity in terms of steps to reach the final state.
Yeah, the depth.
But if I think about BCS wave function, in one step, they reach the state by writing it down.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you define that?
Well, that's a very good question. However, that was not the intended question. We'll come back to that in a minute. Okay, that's a great question, though, putting into a broader perspective. I am going to try one more time to see if I can get the intended question. Just look at the plot and tell me if you have a question looking at the plot.
What's the y-axis?
Yes, what's the y-axis? That was the intended question. X-axis is shown, that's the depth. What's the vertical axis? That's what all good students should be asking, right? When you see a plot, you should ask what the axes are. The vertical axis is what's called XEB, linear XEB. It was something clearly important. That's why this is in the climax figure, figure 4 of the paper. What is linear XEB? Linear XEB is defined as this. So you get a measurement outcome, a particular bit string X of I. You look up the probability for that outcome to occur. And you do that for many bit strings, that is this expectation value, multiply by 2 to the little n is the number of qubits, subtract minus 1. So why would you do something like that? Well, if you have a random, classically random state, and you are living in a 2 to the n dimensional space, the probability of any bit string will be 1 over 2 to the n. And if you have such a state, if your data looks like that, this XEB will be zero. On the other hand, if your data is following the distribution of Porter-Thomas distribution, which is a little harder to show that why that becomes what I'm going to claim to be, but it is something that it can be shown, that if the probability distribution is following Porter-Thomas distribution, the linear XEB will become one. So this was a measure that the authors used on this problem, which does not have order parameter. Not only that it does not have order parameter, it does not have some loop operator. There is no known loop to measure. There is nothing that is known that can be measured to assess the nature of the state. And this was what was used. Now, a complex state would mean that this is approaching one, but there's a problem. Problem is that this probability distribution needs to be looked up from a classical simulation, because we don't know what that is. So the existing approach is you do all this quantum hardware simulation out of the quantum processor hardware, you get these various measurements. But in order to understand what these measurements mean, therefore what kind of state that you have realized, you have to do classical simulation in parallel. Clearly, this is a problem. So how did they go and make the statements about supremacy, which is about not being able to classically simulate? What they did was to use approximate simulation because they have gone to the limits where full-blown simulation was not possible. So the challenge to my group was, can you study just this data without classical simulation and learn something from that data? You know, if somebody gives me two piles of bit strings, can I tell them whether they are from different depths? So compared to wanting to fully reconstruct the density matrix, this is a much more humbler goal. But we are going after a humbler goal because we are going after problems that are at the limit of simulation. What would tell us that this is even in principle possible? I've learned to ask that question after the first experience. I want to know whether something is in principle possible. The reason why this could be in principle possible is there is this notion of K-design. K-design says the way you approach the Porter-Thomas distribution is by first few moments, up to K moments, starting to match the Porter-Thomas distribution. So we want to study the distribution from the data. We are not going to reconstruct the distribution, but we want to get to the notion or information about moments. And that's where the self-attention could help, we thought. We thought because what you do with self-attention is you take data, now each of these vector entries are not going to be individual qubits, but it's going to be the entire bit string. We want to look at a collection of bit string as a collection, and we'll try to learn some aspects of the distribution. We cannot learn the full distribution. We will not have enough data for that. But we want to learn some aspect of the data, the distribution, approximately. So what we've done is to take data from different depths and try to do binary classification, very simple task. And the architecture we used was taking the bit string and putting it through a convolution layer just because there is a geometric information in which how the qubits were, the two qubit gates were applied, only the nearest neighboring qubits were coupled to each other. So we encoded that information through convolution. But then it goes through the self-attention mechanism in the encoder and the decoder. And this is work in progress. So I'm only going to show you small part that we feel are robust and established. And this is one slide of the preliminary results that I'm prepared to share today. So what you're seeing on the left-hand side is, this is all for simulated data, although we've done this for experimental data, but that I'm not quite ready to show in public. But it also works. For simulated data though, what you can see here is that for simulated data up to 36 qubits, very expensive to simulate, we could calculate the linear XCB, and what you see is that XCB approaches one at the depth of about 8. So after that depth, it becomes unchanging. On the right-hand side is the data given to our quantum attention network. The task that we gave the network is to please distinguish two piles of the data. So we work with 500,000 bit strings for each depth. made out of 50 different circuits. And we divide the data into 75% for training, 25% for testing. And what is shown here is a testing accuracy. And the task is take one depth, compare contrast to depth 20. So what you're seeing here is that at depth 4 data was reliably distinguished from depth 20 data. And depth 6 also reliably distinguished. Interestingly, this little uptick is resembling the uptick in the XCB. There is probably geometric information. And the network's ability to distinguish from depth 8, depth 20, plunges down to 50%. 50% is random guess, so that's failing to distinguish. So what we're seeing here is the right-hand side, which is entirely based on just the data without any preconceived notion of please calculate this, is clearly tracking the information that you obtain from XCB when the simulation is possible. This means when we go to the limit where simulation is not possible, we can still use our quantum attention network to gain a sense of complexity in the state of this many qubits.
Do you have noise in your simulation?
Pardon?
Do you have noise in your simulation?
Oh, we can also add noise. So this is noiseless simulation, and the reason why we did noiseless simulation is because we wanted to first see whether you can learn pure sense of complexity without noise. What happens with noise is in real system, as you increase the depth number of depth, the level of noise also increases. So the data that I'm not prepared to broadcast is simulation with noise, but also actual experimental data. And in both of those, the quantum attention network can distinguish different depths or different characteristics in the data. But once you start to add noise, and if you make the degree of noise different between two piles, that's definitely going to be learned. Does that answer your question? Great.
Especially about 50%.
50%. So on the right-hand side is the classification accuracy. 50% means it's right half the time, which it would be the random guess. Yeah, so that's the baseline. That's being confused. Yes.
Yes. You mentioned that you can discriminate between 20 and 4.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you can discriminate between 20 and 4 and 20 mm-hmm. and 6. Can you discriminate between 4 and 6 and 4 and...
Great question, yes. I haven't put in the slides, but what we did was actually, take 2 to 20, and we can make a matrix, what can be distinguished and what cannot be distinguished. And along the diagonal, you just cannot distinguish because that's you're looking at the same depth. And very satisfactorily, the quantum attention network fails. It's very important when, something fail. It's important for things to fail when it's supposed to fail. So along the diagonal, it fails. Away from diagonal, it is increasingly successful. And as I go compare farther and farther away depth, it is much more successful. We can show you sort of preliminary results in private. Any other questions? All right, I think my time is well over. To summarize, I've talked about data-centric learning of quantum many-body states, looking at X-ray data, and looking at the quantum simulator data. And I just want to end with this slide. I don't know if you have watched the movie. If you haven't yet, it's a great movie. I strongly recommend it. So these actresses are representing the West Area computers. They were human computers before the machine computers became broadly used. And this group learned to program the machine computer that just arrived. There was another group of human computers who didn't. And obviously they lost the jobs, but these group who learned to program the machine computer that came to take out their jobs were, they then became programmers from human computers. So I think, some of the things that are automatable will become automated, and I think it's really important for us to know how, what we can accomplish with what can be automated. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Una. Yeah, so we will take like maybe one or two questions. We are pretty much over time, and we had a lot of questions in between. So.
Thanks. These are some really nice discoveries. So I was just having a very quick question about your Rydberg system analysis. So we also did some machine learning of the Rydberg array phase diagram and simulated data from EEGES, who might also been here. And we also found more phases than what was previously known, and we did not interpret the phases. And you have experimental data, right? Mm-hmm. While we had simulated data. And the problem we had when we changed our boundary conditions, we saw that the phases changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so from talking to other people, it seems like many of these phases do not persist in a thermodynamic limit. Do
right.
you know that the same thing occurs in your system too?
Right. So that's the problem having to do with the data itself, right? So machine cannot change the data or
exactly.
fix the data, right? Machines only, at best, machine will be able to pull out what is going on in the data, but it's not going to improve the data. What is a fundamentally a problem in the data will always remain. Now, then the question is whether we should worry about, you know, something that is being observed in the data being a reflection of finite size effect. That depends on what you're after. If what you're after is a statement about thermodynamic limit, obviously. If what you're after is trying to figure out what is going on in the quantum hardware that you have set up, then, well, you got to figure out what is going on, right? So I think finite size effects, out of equilibrium, all of these things are now gaining, you know, different nuances because until these hardwares became available, these were very abstract notions. You know, many respectable physicists will say, you know, if you're not going to tell me about thermodynamic limit, go away. Now, 1,000 qubits is not going to give you thermodynamic limit. So what do we do? Throw out 1,000 qubits? Or figure out what we can do with 1,000 qubits, right? So I don't think, I think it might be useful for us to recognize people in this room, you know, we are kind of at a frontier. And perhaps the way we think with the experiences we have may not fit into the sort of canon of what previous generation has established. It's going to take time for people to accept and become familiar with unfamiliar notions that you are bringing up to the table. You got to have patience and perseverance, but you have to recognize it can take patience, it can take perseverance, but you should never give up. Because we're making discoveries. We are in a different era. We're living a different era right now, I think.
Thanks.
Okay, one quick question.
Hi, amazing talk. So regarding to the last portion, learning the complexity, I wonder if the machine is able to predict what is a unitary design that maybe given the B-string is not enough, but like given randomized measurement basis results, is that, do you think the machine will able to recognize that?
So clearly it was learning, you know, something. And so we've struggled with that problem for over a year. And for the first several months, we were just simply failing. And then we started to succeed. And once we started to succeed, we were able to take different parts away and fail again. So we know what different parts of the architecture is doing. And specifically, we know the attention mechanism and learning correlation through attention mechanism is essential. That means it's in principle possible to then try to learn a little bit more from what it is learning. we haven't quite gone there yet. But what I think is really exciting is that if I just, because I know that attention mechanism in the encoder plays a particular role, and using attention in the pooling also plays a particular role. There are very sort of simple aspects to the architecture that we understand what is going on. And I think these sort of very simple aspects that are quite different from, there are nonlinear layer and whatnot, but these simple aspects that are quite different from and not as unwieldy as, say, CNN, could mean that there are many ways that we can build on what we've got. But there are many dimensions, directions that we could explore, and that definitely will be one of those.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think looking at the time, we will move on to our coffee break. We will continue at 2:45 sharp. And let's thank Una again.